This podcast is brought to you by MyScore IQ. MyScore IQ services are here to help you be prepared when it comes to making big financial decisions, such as buying or refinancing your home or purchasing that new car. Try it out for only $1 for a 7-day trial. You'll receive your FICO scores from all three major credit bureaus, along with active credit report monitoring and alerts for changes to your credit report and possible suspicious activity.
MyScore IQ services can help you be in the best position possible when you take that step to apply for a home or auto loan, all for $1 for a 7-day trial. Visit MyScoreIQ.com/Todd to learn more. That's MyScoreIQ.com/Todd.
Welcome back to the Talking Stocks podcast. It's what we do. I'm Joe. With Todd here, as always. Todd, how are you?
I'm doing good, Joe. It's sunny in New Hampshire, sort of.
Yeah, still a little foggy at my house down by the coast. But, you know, I see some blue sky up there. You know, there's some optimism.
Hopefully that optimism will flow through to stocks, which once again, a little bit better on Thursday, bounced a little bit. Friday, we're bouncing around now. But beginning part of the week, definitely a lot more of that continuation of what we've talked about the last few weeks with stocks in distribution, growth stocks in distribution. Obviously, technology stocks, the QQQ, which is the exchange traded fund for the NASDAQ 100, significantly trailing some of these other parts of the market, cyclicals, industrials, finance.
Yeah. So I want to get going today by just talking about this crazy incident that's going on in the Suez Canal in Egypt. Never did I think that we would be talking about Egypt on the Talking Stocks podcast, but here we are. And boy, do they have an issue in the Suez Canal, don't they, Todd?
We are multinational, Joe.
Talking yes,
about
we are.
Multinational things. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure you've seen them, and I'm sure all our listeners have gotten a lot of laughs from some of the meme. The meme game has been strong.
Yes. What was the one I saw? It was like, it was a play on Grand Theft Auto Vice City. And it was like Suez Vice City or something. I'm going to see if I can find it. But yeah, that's, oh, here it is. Fast and Furious, Suez Drift. That was what it was. Just, and the ship is just still stuck there. And it sounds like it's going to be stuck there for quite a while. So we might be talking about this like next week and the week after too.
It's probably not too surprising that it could get stuck there for a while, given the fact they're trying to push it off with a bulldozer and two guys leaning on it like it's a car stuck in a snowdrift in New Hampshire.
Yeah, I think they're going to need some bigger equipment, but it has some interesting potential implications on the markets just because of how much value in goods flows through there, right? We were talking before the show and we figured out that it was somewhere between 5 and 6% of the world's oil flows through the Suez Canal. And obviously there are gigantic container ships like the one that's stuck that are carrying who knows what, but we can assume that it's goods that are manufactured in Asia that are being brought towards Western markets, Europe and the United States. And so there are certainly some companies out there that are going to be seeing some supply chain disruptions, right?
I mean, the sheer size of the ship is just crazy to think about. I mean, the fact that it's as long as the Empire State Building is tall. And then you think about, I don't know if you've ever gone port, we have a port here called Portsmouth, and every once in a while they come in with, and that's the ships that come in there, they're just not even close to the size of this thing. And you look at the containers on top and how high they go. It's just, it's a mat. People were saying, oh, well, just unload it. And yeah.
Yeah, that's not how that works.
not easy. And that's a very, I mean, what are you going to do? You can bring those cranes in on the water and try to load them from that. That is a very difficult job. That's a, like a military precision Chinook helicopter. I mean, that's not easy. I mean, I have heard that companies like Caterpillar are trying to, they've got machinery stuck on there. There's been some chatter that maybe they would try to get it offloaded there and move it some other way. Possible, I suppose, to try and do this, but geez, you know, I guess it depends on where they are in the on it and if they can get access to it relatively easily without having to move all sorts of other stuff on this Jenga puzzle around. You talked about, you know, roughly 5 or 6% of oil and natural gas flowing through the canal. Obviously, if you're in the canal now, you're kind of stuck. You know, it's not like you can throw this thing in reverse, beep, 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 you know, get it out like your Amazon delivery
truck. Right. The thing's a quarter of a mile long.
Yeah. I mean, this is not, you're not going to be able to back this thing up. If you're the captain right behind that ship, you must be like, oh, come on.
Exactly. Exactly.
You've got all the people behind you and you can't get from out underneath you. So, I mean, yeah, we saw on Wednesday, I think it was, oil prices jump up significantly. I think crude oil prices jumped about 6%. And we're coming into a very seasonally strong time. We'll talk during our smattering about some of the energy stocks that are on my radar. April tends to be a pretty good play for both natural gas and oil stocks. We'll get to that in a bit, but certainly that created a one-day bounce in those stocks. They pulled back a little bit yesterday. They're rallying again today. I imagine you'll get some crazy news flow over the course of the next week. And once they uncork that bottleneck, the day that that's announced, probably oil stocks will trade down. Probably good opportunity to buy on that day because, you know, you're going to have, like many things, this kind of knock-on effect where it's like it's not going to be seamless. You're going to have now ports that are used to processing a certain number on a certain day. Now we're going to go from processing a lot of to none to all of a sudden a ton showing up at the same time. And then you've got other ships now, they're trying to go around the horn and avoid the canal. So that's going to screw up a whole bunch of that flow of port activity. So definitely something that we're going to have to keep eyes on and see how it flows through. And then, of course, there is a potential inflation impact. You know, if some of this stuff does create shortages of certain products and goods, there could be some price increases on the horizon. Even in coming at the same time that people tend to have a little bit more money in their pockets because of the stimulus checks that just went out. So I think there are definitely reasons to pay attention to this from a financial standpoint. Obviously, we're still talking a relatively small amount, but I mean, you can have a tip. Small amounts can be tipping points when it comes to pricing. So yeah, we'll keep everybody up to date on that as we go forward. It'll be interesting to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I heard somewhere yesterday that they're saying the ship could be stuck there for a week to a week and a half, which, again, I don't know if that's really going to have an effect on consumers here in the United States or in Europe. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. It's an interesting little experiment for sure. So I want to pivot a little bit, and we were talking about this last week after we recorded, and we realized that we had never really talked about like the details and the process behind what you call raising cash. So essentially increasing your cash position in your portfolio, kind of anticipating when you're going to buy on a down day, right? So I want to, and I think many of our listeners would also love it if you could just give us an overview of kind of how you go about that. How you initiate that is probably the biggest question mark. And then, of course, how you start to trim down your cash position when the time comes.
Yeah, I mean, it's okay. So some people think there are multiple ways to look at this. Well, some people think, okay, you know what? I'm going to run fully invested. I'm just going to be flat out fully invested. I'm invested for the long term. I'm just going to put money to work as soon as I have it. In my personal investing, I don't do that. I will do that if we are in a early stage trend. If, for example, okay, so let's just go back in time for a second, well, the way back machine to January and February of 2020, when we started to get a very elevated reading on the percentage of stocks that were trading 5% or more above the 200-day moving average, which is that overbought, oversold indicator that every once in a while we'll share with our subscribers in the service link below. And yeah, and that got up to about, I think it was around 55%, which at the time was pretty extreme reading for us. And that prompted me to get a little bit cautious and start thinking on a macro level that we might be getting a little bit overextended and that the easy money may have been made. And maybe it makes some sense just to put a little cash in my pocket and rein in some of my exposure to be able to take advantage of maybe stocks going on sale soon. And sure enough, we did indeed get that, obviously, peaking out in February. I looked stupid for having cash for a few weeks up until that peak. And then we rolled down into March and I was deploying cash within those first few weeks of March. And then as we put in the bottom in mid-March and started to rally, I was mostly back invested. I think I probably had about 5 or 10% that was still kicking around in cash that I then committed back in. And that being then the early stage and that liftoff of our overbought indicator going from 55% more than, you know, 5% above the 200-day moving average to like it was a single-digit reading, Joe. I don't know if you we got down below 10% on that reading, which is a very actionable buy point. So at that point, I would say to myself, well, there's really not a lot of reason for me to be cute here with cash. You know, I'm back in, it's early cycle. We're starting to move up. At the time, we were just finding out exactly how much the Fed and the Treasury were going to throw at the marketplace to keep the financial markets running rather than getting locked up. So you could run full cash now for a while. Fast forward, in that reading that we were talking about, that overbought reading, starts to get elevated again, goes up to the 55%, got up to 60%, started to make me nervous again, take a little bit of cash back in. We pulled back a little bit, then we went again. We didn't pull back nearly as much. And I think that, you know, you and I had mentioned on the show a couple of weeks ago that we were flirting with 80%, which is just a crazy, crazy number. And that made me very nervous. And that, again, start to raise cash. So the question then becomes, okay, when you're starting to raise cash, Todd, how are you doing that? And there's a couple of different ways that you can raise cash. You can, I think that one good way to do it, I mean, everybody should go into every trade that they do with a thesis and a catalyst and, you know, an uncle point. So if you're wrong on your timing and you violate your uncle point, and for me, I really don't, I like being right pretty much right away. And if I'm not right pretty much right away, when I get down more than 10%, I start getting nervous. So maybe your uncle point is a loss of 10%. And you say to yourself, you know what? The stock broke down. I was wrong in my timing. I'm down 10%. I'm going to eliminate that one from the holding. So maybe you're raising cash that way, right? You can also take the approach of saying, you know what, I'm going to create an A through F or a 1 through 5, some sort of a ranking system for conviction, and look at the holdings in your portfolio and say, okay, well, maybe I'm putting an Amazon in a 1, and a 1 to me is a never sell. I'm just going to hold it forever and I don't really care where it is. I'm not caring about it technically. I don't care about anything. I'm just going to hold it forever. So maybe that's a 1. But then you look at something else, like maybe you got into one of the SPAC stocks because other people were talking about it and it moved up a lot, but it's really not a very high conviction trade for you. You were just kind of riding other people's coattails, or you were, you know, maybe this is an interesting stock, but it's a lot of never sell. So maybe that would be on the lower end. So if you were doing a 1 through 5 or an A through F, it would be a 5 or an F. And those would be the ones, after you've done that to all the stocks in your portfolio, those would be your first source of cash. So you'd say, you know what? I'm just going to cut bait on those. I'm going to get rid of those. I don't really know the story or understand the story well enough. I'm going to admit that to myself. I'm going to accept that I either made a little money or I lost a little money, but I really kind of reacted to the stories of the day rather than being proactive and searching out the best companies that I want to own. So that's another source of cash, Joe. And then I would say that the final source of cash for me when I'm trying to raise cash would be to look at stocks that have made me a lot of money, but maybe those have grown to a percentage of allocation in my portfolio that threatens my sleep at night comfort. That's different number, Joe, for everybody else. Your number is probably different than my number. You know, you're younger than I am. You know, I'm married, I have kids, I've got other things that I'm thinking about when it comes to what would keep me up at night with my money. So when I get above 10%, I start to really get a little antsy, you know? And that for some people, they'd be like, I don't care if I lose 10% of my capital, big deal. You know, so everybody has to come up with their own number. Joe, do you have a number, Joe? Like what would get, do you have an allocation number that if you get above a certain allocation, you would be like, oh geez, I really should cut some of that.
Not really, just because like relatively my, you know, the amount of money I have invested is pretty small. So I think that like on Fidelity, which is the platform I use, they have like these analysis tools that kind of show like, okay, here's your portfolio risk. And it usually shows that my portfolio is like pretty risky on like their objective measure, just because I don't have a lot of cash to deploy. And so I'm not as well diversified as you are, certainly. I mean, what do you own? Like 80 to 100 stocks, something like that?
Yeah.
I have
back a couple, but I think I'm still right in that zone.
Yeah, I thought I had a count here on Active Trader Pro, but I don't. But it's like in the neighborhood of 18 to 25 at any particular time. So naturally,
most people have. Yeah.
Yeah. Naturally, I'm going to have some that are probably higher than an ordinary person would be able to tolerate. Like I know, for example, my two biggest holdings were Visa and MasterCard, and they were probably both like 18% the last time I checked. Doesn't really bother me because I know that they're both really stable stocks. So I think in the future, you know, when I have, say, when I've got a couple hundred grand in there, I'll think a lot differently, and I'll definitely naturally be more diversified as well. There are some stocks that I would love to own, and I don't have the capital to deploy right now. So for me, there isn't a particular number. Usually I have kind of a different strategy where I tend to trim my top holdings if I need to raise a little bit more cash to buy something. So if there's a stock that I'm like, oh, that's at a really good price, or oh, I think they just reported great earnings or something like that, then I might go back and say like, oh, look here, I have, let's find an example. I have 11 shares of this Fidelity software as a service ETF. Do I really need 11 shares? No. So I'll take 5 off the table, cut my position in half. It's still a fairly significant position. And then I kind of seal in my profits as well, and go out and buy whatever's interesting to me at the time. So to answer your question, long story short, no, there isn't a particular number, but I expect that there will be a number in the future, and it'll probably be somewhere around 20%.
You know, it's great that you mentioned that too, because it made me think of some other things too. There are other ways to raise cash, including, you know, if you're investing in your account, like a 401k or 403b, where you're making regular dollar cost averaging contributions or whatever, and then you're allocating them, so sitting in cash until you allocate them, you can raise cash just by doing nothing. So, you know, maybe saying to yourself, yeah, I'm not going to buy any more shares of the S&P 500 mutual fund or ETF. I'm going to just sort of sit on my hands for the next couple months and see if things start to fall. And then I'll start to contribute that money that way. So, you know, there's a lot of different theories on ways to make money. And one of them is that, you know what, buy great stocks, let your winners run. Who cares if it ends up being 80% of your portfolio, right? You could do that as long as you had other money coming in that you can be setting aside to be able to use to take advantage of that next big opportunity. And I think that's really the value to me in being able to raise cash when it looks like the markets are getting a little overextended, is really in having the optionality to take advantage of the leaders that emerge the next time markets go up. Because it's not always the same leaders on the way out as they were on the way in.
Right.
And I think that, you know, just to go back to my 2020 experience, if I look at my best performers from March 2020 to December 2020, Carvana wasn't in my portfolio at the end of 2019. That was up 1,000% for me. Fulgent Genetics wasn't in my portfolio at the end of 2019. That was up 1,000% to me, right? I had Tesla, but I added to Tesla, and that ended up being a huge winner for me as well. So, you know, for me, it gives you the optionality to take advantage of whatever the next leaders are coming out of that basket. So I think that's where the value is or can come from in maybe doing some massaging at of your portfolio at these different points in time to have cash available to be able to take advantage of that opportunity.
Right. And again, that cash position is going to vary for each individual. But just to get an idea, because I'm guessing there are some people out there who are kind of curious, what's the maximum amount of as a percentage of your portfolio, what's your maximum cash position you would ever hold in at any point in time?
I don't want to say a number that I would regret later on, because theoretically I'm flexible enough to say to myself, I'll go 100% cash if I see the end of the world coming.
Right,
know?
Right.
I mean, so the most that I would ever hold would be 100%, right? I would say that if you just look at recent history, so since the Great Recession coming out of the 2009 period, the most that I've ever held would probably be a little over between 30 and 40%. I was probably close to that amount in January and February, but you know, by the time I finished raising cash. More recently, I did get up above 20. I was 20, 24, 25% cash. I've since reduced that down. I'm now only about, if I'm doing the math in my head, I think I'm probably around 7 or 8% cash. Some of that came from selling low conviction names. Some of that came from pairing, and some of it came from, I use a SEP IRA, and I contributed more money from my SEP IRA for tax purposes. So it can, like I said, the cash could come from different places, and I'm contributing. I'm watching now because we go into April to see, you know, April's historically, we talked about this on the podcast with Jeffrey Hirsch, Stock Traders Almanac. We talked about weakness at the end of March, turning into strength in April. Be interesting to see how we go forward here in April, but I am continuing to model that. So I am committing more cash that I had raised, and I'll probably be mostly invested by the first couple of days of April. That's kind of where I'm sitting right now. And then, so as a general rule of thumb though, maybe keep 5 to 10% cash for that next best idea that you have, and then you can increase it or decrease it, you know, at these different points in time.
Perfect. So you mentioned it a couple of times, so I'm going to use this as a semi-clumsy segue into a listener question we had from earlier this week. So we had a response to one of Todd's tweets from Curtis. I'm not going to try to pronounce your last name, Curtis, because I'm just going to botch it. So, but it's B-R-A-U-S-E. So forgive me, Curtis. But he asked, where does it begin? He was wondering about IRA and retirement funds. He said it would be awesome if you and Joe would consider at some point discussing mutual funds versus ETFs, which ETFs you love long-term. Just started a Roth and would love to learn. Thanks. So that is true. I don't think that we haven't really devoted any time to retirement accounts. We talked about it a little bit in the Young Investor episode that we recorded back in October and released. I republished that as a clip back in January, I believe. But this is a perfect opportunity because you did mention it a couple times, especially with the automatic contributions into a 401k. So I'll let you take that as you wish, Todd, and answer Curtis's question.
Yeah, I'm going to speak in generalities because obviously everybody's situation is a little bit different. But so I'm going to speak to the majority of listeners. You know, the majority, what would work best for the majority of listeners? And I have opinions on this. And my opinions may not be right, and they may not jive with what you want. So that's my disclaimer, right, Joe? but here it goes. So what I would say is that for 90% of investors, the bulk of their assets should be contributed to their 401k or 403b plan at work. And yes, those 403 and 401k plans, they usually do not allow you to buy individual stocks. So you would have to buy mutual funds. Maybe you get lucky and you can buy ETFs in there, but probably mutual funds. And for most investors, that's really where the focus should be. And I get asked this a lot from students in the How to Talk Stocks class. They're going out, they're graduating, getting new jobs. What should I ideally be contributing to that 401 and 403b plan? And I would say, honestly, 15%, 10 to 15%. And most people will be like, but I was going to buy a BMW. That's my monthly payment.
Don't do that.
And I would say, don't do that. Drive the Toyota Corolla for a little bit longer. And, you know, really, because time is on your side. I mean, every extra dollar you put in now because of compound interest is just money in the bank when you get to retirement. So,
and also just remember, nobody cares what kind of car you drive.
Yeah, nobody.
You do. That's about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I've my goal, Joe, is to have a vehicle that reaches 300,000 miles. That's my goal. So I like to keep my vehicles. And I don't drive the flashiest, you know, latest thing. I'd rather invest that money. It's just how I tend to view the world. Other people have different priorities, but I would say 10 to 15%. If you can't do that, say you do your math and you're like, oh geez, I can only do 6, then make it 7. If I can only do 8, do a 9. If I can do 11, do 12, right? And then see if your HR department offers an auto escalation feature, which will automatically increase your contribution each year by X percent. So you could say, increase it automatically by 1%. I'm gonna set it on autopilot. And then that way, when you get your raises, X percent is already gonna go directly into the 401k. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to second guess it. You're not gonna get emotional and say, maybe I shouldn't do that at this time of the cycle, you know, whatever. Just hands off, let it go. And then honestly, for most people, depending on your age, if you're younger, tilt towards growth, and, you know, really hard to beat an S&P 500 mutual fund. It really is. For the expense ratios, you're usually lower than growth funds. And you're going to get exposure across the business cycle, across the economic cycle. So you get early stage benefit from finance and technology. And then as it rotates, you're going to be able to go and you'll have exposure through S&P 500 to materials and consumer goods and energy stocks. So, I mean, I think that it's hard to beat that. I think from an individual side, we do have subscribers who use the sector rankings that we put out and the industry rankings that we put out to do an aggressive ETF strategy. I think that that can play out pretty nicely. So when in our sector ranking, if technology scores very well, then you could own the XLK or the IGV ETF. If healthcare scores well, you could own the XLV or something like that. Just pay attention to expense ratios, because on ETFs, you can find, you know, differences of 10 basis points to 20 basis points on sector and industry ETFs. And hey, if you don't have to pay that as an expense to, you know, for the fund manager, better have it and leave it in your pocket. So all things considered, not all technology or healthcare or energy funds are created equal. So take a look at the holdings and make sure you're comfortable with the top 10 or 15 holdings that are listed in those ETFs, because they may be different from ETF to ETF. And you want to make sure that if you're buying a consumer discretionary ETF and you're not really comfortable with it having its biggest position GameStop, maybe you would want it to be a different consumer discretionary ETF. So pay attention to the top holdings and pay attention to the expense ratios associated it. And then you can, like I said, use our rankings to help you navigate into the specific industry or sector ETFs that are scoring best for us at any given point in time. I will say that we did, Joe, back in the day, crunch numbers and found that most of the majority of the return of the S&P 500 came from financials, technology, healthcare, and energy. So if you wanted to have maybe a more aggressive S&P 500 hands-off kind of approach, maybe pick those four ETFs and just let those ride. Or if you have access to sector mutual funds in your 403 or 401k plan, consider those. So that's just random thoughts on the subject. Not sure if I answered the question for you, listener, but hopefully it gives you at least some things to think about.
Yes, I hope so too. One thing I would just add is, you know, if you just started a Roth IRA, I assume you're fairly young. Your profile picture looks like you're fairly young. So I would encourage you to do a little research on mutual funds that, you know, may target like green energy or something like that, just because in the next 10 years, sky is the limit for stuff like that. Green energy, I would also put like space in there. Not SPCE, but, you know, a space related ETF or mutual fund, just to give it a look and, you know, see how your whatever broker you have, whether it's Fidelity or Schwab or any of them, they should all have like some sort of rating system that'll show you, and you can compare their returns over time compared to the S&P's returns and stuff like that. So if you find a mutual fund that's, you know, green energy or something like that, and you see that it's been around for 15 years and the average annual return is 40%, go for it, man. I mean, not going to say put all your eggs in that basket, but I think that's also a great way to kind of branch out and diversify.
Yeah, I think as long as you're going in with eyes wide open, recognizing that it could be volatility and it could be more volatility than the S&P 500 mutual fund, as long as it's money that you don't need within the next 3 to 5 years, then yeah, why not? The other point that raises, Joe, and I think it's a good point, is that, you know, the temptation as investors is that I'm going to pick the one winner. Well, oftentimes in emerging areas like space or green energy or machine learning or quantum computing or whatever, it's very hard to, or even if you look back to marijuana or betting or whatever, it's hard to pick the one. And what an ETF allows you to do is get a basket exposure. And the one that jumps to mind right now is like Arc Genomics, Arc G, you know, giving you exposure to all those genetic testing plays and the genomic biopharma companies. So rather than having to pick the best one and being wrong as a binary event, there's value, I think, in taking that basket approach and, you know, relying on the professional manager and paying a little bit more in expense ratio for that. But I think it does make sense to do it.
Yeah. The last thing I would say is if you're going to go for that kind of, I guess we could call it an aggressive ETF or mutual fund strategy, don't look at your portfolio every day, because you're going to see especially on a good day, you might be up 1% and your best mutual fund might be up 3%. You're thinking, awesome. And then you go into the specific holdings and say it's the SPY, just to use something that we're all familiar with. And then you go into the SPY and you see, oh, but Tesla was up 12% today. And you're just going to be hitting yourself over and over again. But over time, you will do better than you would with an individual stock. And so when Tesla goes down 12%, you're not going to go down with it.
Yeah, it's almost about the smoothing of returns, right?
Exactly.
It smooths the returns.
That's all. I think you should be all okay. Diversification is really is just, you know, making, being a little bit more risk averse and risk tolerant. Yeah, for sure. So I guess with that, we will go into our weekly smattering. If you're ready, Todd.
I am. I have some stocks to share. So I guess we'll jump in and share screen. Listeners, if you're on the podcast listening via, you know, one of the great podcast partners that we have, we do also post these to YouTube, so you can see the charts when we pull them up. So feel free to go back later and view them on YouTube. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, Joe. I'm going to ask you to give me a thumbs up as soon as you can see it. Awesome. So I am on Seeking Alpha's website. I'm under our Limelight Alpha Top Stocks for Tomorrow service. And you can see I've already posted a couple of this week's reports, the best and worst large ADRs report, large cap report, and mid cap report. So let's click on the large cap report, Joe. And if we scroll down, you can see that we show the large cap ranking. It's still industrials, financials, energy, despite some weakness over the last week and a half. Energy is still ranked number third in large cap. Services and consumer. Technology is middle pack. So, you know, you have to be selective there. Look at the industry ranking in technology. And then still avoid basics, healthcare, and utilities overall. However, I will sidebar that, Joe. As you know, we're rolling next week the scores to reflect second quarter seasonal trends over the last decade. Healthcare is a strong seasonal basket in the second quarter. So there should be a natural tailwind to that score over the coming weeks. So listeners, keep an eye on healthcare in the rankings, see if it moves up. If it does, you can go out and buy some of those. And then if you scroll down past the best scoring and the worst scoring list, just looking at the best and worst industries, I mentioned you should be focused on top industries and technology because the basket overall is neutral. Semiconductors still at the top, integrated semi, semi equipment materials, broadline semi. Again, I would say, Joe, just again, seasonality, usually peaks for semiconductors. I think April might be the last of those really strong months. So if you got a big gain from us talking about it all the way back to whatever it was, November or October, where we started really talking about semi stocks, can't hurt to start to put some of that in your pocket, perhaps, in that basket. If we go back up, and I'm going to click back and just go to the mid caps before I go to individual stocks, should be relatively similar. Yep, industrials, consumer good, energy and services. Technology actually slightly below average, but we do have some bunching here in mid-cap. Usually bunching in the neutral area occurs before a shift in leadership. So probably gonna watch and see what happens with April. All right, on to individual stocks that are scoring high, that are on my radar. And let's start off with Flowers. Flowers Foods, high scoring stock, breads, rolls, and bakery products. Interestingly enough, has a tendency to do pretty well in the second quarter as far as seasonality, 11% year over year growth in the most recent quarter. And, you know, $13, $20 in earnings expected, stock trading around $24. I always do like, Joe, from a technical perspective, taking a look at where we are in relationship to the 200-day moving average and the 21-day moving average, which is the green line, and the 50-day moving average. Those are up curling and crossing over the 200. Would be surprised if we see this thing move up into the mid-20s. So that's one stock that's on my radar. Another seasonally strong, high-scoring stock in the research heading into the second quarter, Energizer Holdings. We may have mentioned this on the podcast in a prior week as well, Joe. 15% year-over-year growth in the fourth quarter on a revenue. 45% expected earnings per share growth in 21, 12% in 22. And I really do, I like that setup. Again, coming off the 200-day moving average, uptrending 21-day, 50-day above the 200 as well. New CEO in January. So I think this is a company worth watching. In the energy space, like I mentioned, we saw some pullbacks off of those big rallies that we got in February. Diamondback Energy, a Permian player, is one of my favorites in that space, Joe. $88 peak here in early March, retreated all the way to the 50-day at about $70 per share, bounced off of that, and I think has an opportunity in April to rally up again towards those new highs, maybe even eclipse them. If you look at the year-over-year earnings expectations, again, crude oil prices are rising and have been rising because we're stimulating the economy. And then, Joe, we talked at the top of the show about the Suez Canal and some of the supply disruption there. And, you know, we're looking at 304 in EPS in 2020, potentially going to 713 in 21, going to $9.12 in 2022. So if you're looking for an energy stock to play for April historical strength in the basket, that would be one that's on my radar. I would also take a look at Continental Resources. That's another one, CLR, pulled back almost to the 50-day and now turning back up. Another shale player that you might want to get exposure to. I would also, in that same basket, look at CNX Resources, which actually held up better than all of them. Barely pulled back, touched the 50-day, now breaking out to new highs. So from a relative strength standpoint, new high in the relative strength, that's one I would definitely have on my list. Moving outside of that space, maybe take a look at Home Depot. We took a look at Lowe's the other week. Lowe's been a big winner. These home supply companies tend to do well in the summertime as people are doing things around their house. Nursing has high, if you look at the nurseries, that's a high margin business for these companies. So, you like to see them, you like to see stuff going on in the home and garden area, which brings me naturally to Site, a stock we've talked about again on the show last few weeks for strong seasonality. Site One Landscape Supply, symbol SITE. I do own that one personally now. So I want to make sure that everybody's aware of that. And then I guess I'd finish it up with two more stocks, Joe. O'Reilly Automotive. I really like the setup here, breaking out of that prior high of 496. Probably get a down day here. You'd probably buy it again slightly below 500. Double-digit revenue growth, double-digit earnings per share growth, and tends to have strong seasonality because of the reporting from the winter season. You know, automotive demand for automotive supply parts, so these almost benefits from breakdowns in the winter months. It's a tough period for cars. So they're going to report those numbers. My expectation with the numbers will be pretty good, and that'll put a tailwind behind the stock. And then finally, Constellation Brands, which people probably know for their Corona Light brand of beer heading into the summer. Some pretty decent seasonality for this stock, sitting right above its 50 and its 21-day moving average, both of which look like they're upturning a little bit. Solid revenue growth last quarter, up 22% year over year. And earnings growth in the 7% expected in 21, 7% expected in 2022. So STZ is the symbol there on Constellation Brands. We can wrap it there. That's a pretty good smattering, Joe.
Yeah, I'd say so. All right. So with that, I think we'll wrap things up. Any last words for us this week, Todd?
No, don't forget to check out our sponsor. We'll put a link below. It's new for Limelight Alpha for our podcast this week. So
yes, MyScore IQ. We're very excited to have them on board.
Absolutely. So please support our sponsor, and looking forward to talking again next week.
Absolutely. All right. We will see you, talk to you all next week. Take care, everybody.